CataractCoach.com, podcast series, episode number 164, with Dr. Dan Reinstein. How physics, jazz, and passion helped advance refractive surgery. You're going to love this podcast.
Welcome back to our Cataract Coach podcast. And today I've got a very special guest, a very special treat for all of us. That is my dear friend, Dr. Dan Reinstein. Dan, welcome to our podcast.
Thank you so much for inviting me to speak.
Of course. Now, you obviously are very well known in the refractive surgery world, certainly a household name. But it's very interesting. You didn't start off in medicine. You started off studying physics.
Well, you could say that. I was interested in anything physics that was to do with sound. So I developed an ultrasound scanner at Cornell University for the anterior segment, which is now called the InSight 100. But I also was very interested in jazz sound. So, you know, I play the saxophone. And so, yeah, so as long as it's sound, I'm interested in it.
Well, to say you play the saxophone is a little bit of an understatement. You're a renowned saxophonist, right?
Well, you know, I don't know what, you know, when my patients come to the jazz club and they go, oh my God, this is what's going on here. And I say, no. Eye surgery is just my hobby.
So is this the 606 club you talked about, right?
That's right. Exactly.
Right. So, and yeah, even when I saw you recently in a meeting, you brought your tiny little soprano sax.
I always bring it with me. I don't go to a meeting without it.
Wow. And what's your normal sax that you play at home then? Alto, tenor?
Well, I'm mainly a tenor and soprano player, and those are in B flat. I have a bunch of altos, but it's in E flat, and so I mainly play tenor and soprano. I mean, at the club, I'll play both, but for traveling, you know, the soprano is this, the one that you saw. It's like a little toy. Yeah.
Well, it's interesting. So you obviously interested in sound, and that became ultrasound, and this kind of really changed the way we're doing these now, with this higher frequency digital like ultrasound. Mm. When you were doing this, when did you realize that when you look at the epithelium of the cornea, the epithelium is not just a covering, but it's like this dynamic refractive layer that can mask stromal irregularity? When did you figure this out?
Well, it's one of these stories where if there's any, you know, residents or medical students listening to this, that they'll hopefully benefit from it. So I did medical school in the UK. I was at Cambridge. I thought, well, you know, I'm sure they've heard of that in the States. I applied to U.S. residencies. I got interviewed at about 8 places, okay. But I only ranked the 3 programs in New York because my purpose of going to the States was to be in New York for the jazz while I was a resident. And I got calls from people that had actually matched me saying, what the hell's going on here? We put you in our top 3. And I was like, oh, I wanted to be in New York. And they were like, dude, you're a foreign graduate. You can't like be so picky. Anyway, they were right, and I didn't get in.
All right.
So I called up Cornell because I thought I had a really good interview there, and Stanley Chang and Jack Coleman and Robert Ellsworth. I mean, and you know, they were very impressed and this and that. And so I called up, and I called Jack Coleman's office, and his secretary picked up, and I said, "Oh, it's Dr. Reinstein calling from London. And she, I'd like to speak to Dr. Coleman if he's available." And she goes, "Oh yeah, okay, I'll put you through." So she just literally put me through, and I was like, "Yo, Dr. Coleman, yes, you know, I interviewed for the residency," and I could almost see his eyes rolling. Okay. And I said, "You know, I just wondered if Vinny, what you would suggest? I mean, I thought that we had a good interview, but you know, I just wonder what is it that I could do next year to, you know, strengthen my application because I'm going to reapply." "Well, you know, maybe you should do some research in the States so that you have, you know, American references." And I said, he said, "Look, I'd like to do research at Cornell." He said, "Well, we don't really have funding right now. But look, if you're ever in New York, you know, just let us know and stop by and we can chat." And I said, "Well, it's funny because I'm actually going to be in New York next Monday." And he said, "Okay, I'll put you through to Lainey and she can maybe arrange for you to come around." "Okay. All right. Well, thanks. Yeah. Okay. Right." I put the phone down. I picked the phone up. "Yes, British Airways. Yeah. I'd like to book a flight to New York, please."
Well, you got to be a go-getter.
You know, that the early bird and, you know, what is it? My father used to say, the harder you work, the luckier you get.
Well, that's so true.
Right. So anyway, so I end up, long story short, at Cornell, they had me working on scanning the ciliary body of rabbit eyes that had been, irradiated with high frequency ultrasound therapeutic probes to do a cyclo destruction procedures. And we were looking at the histology, if you like, acoustically, of the damage that we were doing. And I wasn't interested in really joining a project that was already ongoing and I kind of slot in, do one thing and leave. I was interested in doing something that hadn't been done before.
Right.
Which is hard when you haven't even done ophthalmology yet. But anyway, one night I stayed behind and there was this little rabbit eye in the formalin, and I stayed behind and I popped up the scanner and I was scanning all the bits, the optic nerve, the sclera, this, that. I scanned the cornea and I thought, oh, that's interesting. I wonder what I'm looking at. So I looked at a book and thought, well, that must be the epithelium. Okay. So the next morning I went round to the clinic to Cal Roberts.
Okay, sure.
Okay. Cal, I owe you a lot. And I went around and I said, oh, Dr. Roberts, I'm Dan Reinstein, I'm the research fellow here. Just wondered if I could show you something in the lab. And he said, yeah, sure. So he gets up and walks around. And I sat down in front of this VAX, you know, type in some line code, display the images, show him that I can measure the epithelium. So we can measure the epithelium here with 1 micron precision. Okay. Would that be of any use? And he goes like this. He goes like this. No.
Okay. No.
And that was it. That moment was like, oh my God, I've just, the Simpsons, you know. That was the moment when I realized I just bumped into something that the professor of cornea thought was of no use, and yet it had probably never been measured before.
Correct.
And there must be something it's useful for. And so that's how it happened. And over the next few years, I started scanning some, you know, in situ keratomyelitis cases and complications. And I didn't know, we had no idea what we were looking at. But we started to understand that this epithelium is like a fluid layer and like a viscous fluid. And it basically flows and fills nooks and gets thinner over, you know, peaks and valleys. And started presenting posters at ARVO, you know, and I started my residency at Mount Sinai, and I carried on every night going back to Cornell late at night. And so, yeah, I worked like double shifts, but, you know, pushed this thing along until I finished my residency, went back to the lab for a year. While everyone else was going off to private practice or fellowships, I went back to the lab, $20,000 a year in New York City, doesn't go very far.
Right.
But I knew I had to do this and built the ARC scanner. In fact, the very first ARC scanner, here's the picture. This is me on the floor here.
Oh, wow.
There's my ID. And this camera stand, I stole it from my stepfather's garage. He was a National Geographic photographer. Those pictures back there, that's the Vatican over there. That's Madagascar. That's in Hungary. So anyway, I stole this camera stand from him, and I built this kind of mechano set here to drive a transducer in an arc of 8 millimeters.
Okay.
And Ron Silverman here is the computer scientist who basically led the mechanics of the project. And that was the first time we used it. And that, you know, that's like my iris there. And one thing led to the next. I took it to my fellowship in Vancouver with Hugo Sutton and Simon Holland, and started scanning, you know, a library of horrors that had been generated by people who were really real pioneers of refractive surgery, like the real pioneers, you know, the ones that were like mangling corneas with experimental microkeratomes.
Sure.
And so that's how it started. So that's how we learned that, you know, this layered examination of the cornea is the key to understanding how to fix a complication. And obviously it didn't tell you what to do yet, but we started to understand what was happening. And so one of the most important things that came out of it very quickly, I was involved a little bit on the side and in the first Bausch and Lomb driven topography guided system called TopoLink.
Okay.
And they modified a 217C to a 217Z. They made it a 1 millimeter spot. They had an eye tracker and they were importing topography. And we actually did some eyes based on the stromal surface,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to the front surface, because we had understood that if there was a big irregularity on the stromal surface, the epithelium would just go and smooth most of it over, leaving some irregularity, which is why the patient still had visual problems. And therefore, treating just the topography is a fraction of the problem, because it's the stromal surface irregularity minus what the epithelium compensated. So the law of epithelial compensation, which, you know, should have, you know, reasonably to say has my name on it, is my 1994 poster at ARBA, where we said irregular topography, irregular epithelium. Right. If a cornea presents with irregular topography, by definition, the epithelium has reached its maximum compensatory function.
Right.
And that's why wavefront guided treatments don't work either for highly complex corneas, because the wavefront is, you know, 70% the anterior surface refraction. Mm-hmm. So again, it's a smoothed out version of the actual irregularity. So it's only a part of what needs to be corrected.
It makes a ton of sense. So when doing this, now we realize, thanks to your work, that yeah, if you see patients with apical thinning, like the center of the cornea, the epithelium's thinned out, but it's thicker around it in a donut shape, that is probably an earlier warning sign for keratoconus than even what we're doing with tomography, right?
Than anything. I mean, it's a little bit of dispute, obviously, between myself and the tomography gurus, but I think I'm right. I think it makes sense that if you're looking at the shape of the front surface and the shape of the back surface, and you're trying to determine if a eccentric elevation on the back surface is real or noise, how high does that bump have to be for you to say it's not noise, it's real?
Mm-hmm.
And you know, with orb scan, with pentagam, what do people say, 15 microns or something? With ultrasound, we're measuring the epithelium with 1 micron precision in three dimensions.
Sure.
And so if you're looking at an epithelial map, if you have focal thinning of 3 microns or 4 microns, right where the back surface eccentric elevation is 5 microns.
Right.
That would have been counted as noise by a tomographer doing AI of the back surface. But because there's coincidence of the thinning of the epithelium with that, it tells you that there's an anterior surface cone.
Right.
Anterior surface of the stroma cone, which wouldn't show through on the anterior surface because it's fully compensated for by epithelium. So you got totally normal topography with a back surface eccentric elevation. You're like, I don't know. Look at the epithelial map.
It's thin down.
You know, because
it's the donut shape.
If it's thin, it's keratoconus. And here's the, so I was like so excited presenting this at ASCRS and everywhere, and I was totally ignored. And it was because I was like, guys, this is amazing. Finally, we have an answer to ectasia without a cause. Right. The topography is normal. You did the LASIK, they got ectasia. How the hell did that happen? We can detect these hidden cones before they show on the topography. Totally ignored. When a few years later, I realized the converse of this, which is that you can have inferior steepening, which is proven to not be keratoconus because that's where the epithelium is really thick.
Mm.
Now you show that the epithelium is causing the inferior steepening. There is no way it can be a stromal bump because you'd have epithelial thinning.
Right.
So that categorically excludes keratoconus. So when I showed that 2006, suddenly the OCT companies were like, wait a minute, we got to try and measure epithelium.
Right.
And, you know, David Huang, who is, you know, genius.
Right.
He was working with OptoView and he then immediately started doing epithelial maps. I got one of the early prototypes in 2012, worked very closely with them to, you know, force them to do a 9mm zone for, you know, the color scaling, all of the things that we had learned to use as a screening tool.
Sure.
For keratoconus. And now, I mean, you know, there's like 5, 6, 7 epithelial maps on the market. So it's become a whole industry, you know. But you're right. That what's interesting about that from a sort of social engineering standpoint is that it did not excite the world of ophthalmology, the business of ophthalmology, that we could spot a 1 in 1,000 that wasn't going to get keratoconus, because it's a lot of work to do an ultrasound scan just to get 1 out of 1,000.
Right.
But they were very excited that if you could exclude keratoconus on a weird topography, you could do surgery on it.
Right.
And increase your surgical volume by 7%, because that's the number of eyes that look weird that are actually epithelial, not actual keratoconic. So it's the finances that drove the R&D, not the safety.
Well, that's it. So should your LASIK surgeon now in the community do their topography, tomography, and then only if it's unusual do an epithelial map, or should you do an epithelial map on everyone?
Everyone. See, everyone would have been quite a chore if you had to do it by ultrasound.
Yeah.
But the fact that you can, I mean, and I am like, I'm just going to widen my lens here. This here is my, this is my slit lamp here. Right. This is my slit lamp of the 20th century.
Right.
And right here is my slit lamp of the 21st century. This is an MS-39
from
CSO, approved in the United States.
Yep.
We're talking about how much stuff is not approved in the United States. Well, this is approved in the United States. That is a 1.5 second scan that does a high resolution epithelial map, which I've worked with CSO, I consult for them, sure. And we've really calibrated it. So it's very similar to the ultrasound now. And so now every patient that walks through the door gets an epithelial map. And we find these cases where it's like, whoa, like your light flashes in front of you because you would have done the LASIK on that patient.
Right.
And the beauty is that the way that works now is that when we see a case that's equivocal, then the patient gets shunted to the InSight 100 for our scan.
Mm.
When they have, because the reason why you need confirmation in some of these cases is that ultrasound has about a 1 micron precision and OCT to date only has 3 micron precision.
Gotcha.
So now you go to like level 2 epithelial, you know, perfect mapping with a score that has, that's been, you know, the machine's FDA approved and this keratoconus score is part of an NIH grant that Ron Silverman and I went through and created this AI model back in 2010. Can you believe it? Before it wasn't called, our publication says machine learning or something, but it wasn't called AI back then. And so but the thing is the patient has the scan in the device for the cornea, and then you go like this and do the scans for the anterior segment at the same time.
Mm.
So if the patient then comes out and then the RSK score shows that it actually is a keratoconic eye, without even the patient going home, you then put them in the office and say, yep, we can correct your vision. Oh, great. Okay. When can we do it?
Yeah.
Well, we're going to correct your vision, but probably not the way you thought. Well, what do you mean? I thought I came here for smile. Well, that's not the best procedure for you. What's the best procedure for you? The best procedure for you is to put a very small little contact lens in your eye. It's called an ICL. Oh, I don't want anything in my eye. Then you go into that discussion.
Right.
But the point is, of course, it's very safe to put an ICL in the eye, especially if you're sizing it based on the posterior chamber dimensions from a high-frequency ultrasound scanner.
Sure.
So now that exchange rate or that not ideal sizing, which Saldivar says is in about 20 to 30% of eyes, let's say 5% are really not comfortable. Well, now it's like 0.4% because we're looking behind the iris.
Yeah, yeah.
So we have this workflow, which means every patient gets epithelial screening. Then some of them, about 1 in 10 of those, end up at the ultrasound. Confirmed not keratoconus, no problem, smile. Confirmed actually quite suspiciously keratoconus, shunt to ICL. And the ICL sizing is the best in the world because it's posterior chamber.
Sure. You're not guessing on white to whites.
Oh, my goodness.
Which is antiquated. Well, to look at the official way of doing it from the company, right, is to do based on white to whites.
The company has been doing white to white for 25 years. I am not popular with them because I'm quite vociferous about the difference between convenience and safety.
Right.
And, there is such a thing as cost benefit ratios. I understand healthcare is a business, but I rather than cost benefit, I like to think of what I run here is more to do with the risk benefit. What's the risk of doing the scan? Zero. What's the benefit? Better sizing, better keratoconus screening. So it's risk benefit. Now, yeah, but the machine costs $80,000. Well, okay, but that's chump change compared to, if you're doing 1,000 ICLs a year, or the average person probably does 100 ICLs a year. Exchanging 5 patients.
Yeah.
And it's an ugly surgery, an ICL exchange. No matter how you cut it, it doesn't look very nice when you're kind of yanking this thing out through a tiny little incision. It has to fold up. You're kind of praying that it's not going to swipe the endothelium, I don't know. For me, it's all about safety, then convenience. And it is a bit inconvenient to have a patient have an ultrasound scan in each eye, but it only takes one of my 9 technicians who can do the test 10 minutes.
Right, right.
And when I say 9, it's because it's a robotic scanner, right? So it doesn't depend. It's not like handheld, like a Sonomed, whatever, that you have to have a really experienced technician to make sure that you get the right scans. This is anybody can do it. And now you've got the most confidence you can get. Yeah. And obviously what I've just said in the last 3 minutes is very irritating to a company that wants to not increase their revenue by increasing safety and having more surgeons put the lens in, but by increasing revenue by reducing the level of myopia into which you're putting ICLs in. Which is like, and then they make the argument that there's no night vision problems and you're doing a -3 that would have been perfect with smile.
But yeah, that's also how you built your reputation, right? London Vision Clinic, there's a known reputation. You are going to do whatever is the best. You're going to do whatever is the safest. In fact, one of my extra crazy patients here in Los Angeles sent him to you for surgery. We talked about that.
It was you. Don't worry. I sent you a stuck down pupil that was 3.2 millimeters. The patient wanted perfect distance and near. And what else did they have? Oh, punch in the eye and rip zonules. What else? Al, in the eye was 27 millimeters and the vitreous is attached. And patient was 54 and absolutely needed zero spectacle dependence. But you did a great job.
Well, sometimes we're all get lucky. Tell us a little bit about the clinic you built there, because you've really built quite a beautiful clinic. Haven't visited yet in person, but I certainly need to put it on my list.
You do. I do. It would be such an honor to have you here and show you around. I mean, you know, to me, you are, my goodness, what you're doing is changing the world of education in ophthalmology, because
Brian, how do
you know you are? I mean, I know you used to do it just at UCLA, but there's only have 6 residents a year. That's not a big spread. Now, your expertise is now worldwide and you are being watched. I'm sure you have statistics on this. I don't know what they are. I don't log into your YouTube.
Bananas.
It's bananas, right? But here's the thing. You're dynamic. You can never get bored listening to you narrating. And you also do a lot of very beautiful ballet. You're very dexterous, and you're clever in the way that you assign movements. You don't waste movements. You're always trying to minimize things. I mean, I just would like to ask you here online. Honestly, if I can come and do a fellowship with you.
Okay, sure. We'll swap. I'll do a fellowship with you, even better. We'll swap, but let's do it anytime you want.
All right. That'll be our sabbatical. Yeah. I'll come and to train with you, and then you come and do some whatever here. I don't know what I can teach you, but anyway.
Well, if you could teach me to play a musical instrument, that'd be a great thing, but I have zero talent there.
Well, practice makes perfect.
Right. But your clinic, you really built a beautiful kind of concierge model. And mm-hmm. even though you're super high end and also concierge, you're also doing a tremendous amount of actual research there too.
I think that my experience for 10 years at Cornell in research, sure. and then my experience in Vancouver, where I did my fellowship and then went straight into medical director of a chain that was growing, mm-hmm. you know, 15 clinics a year. And the last year that I was medical director, we did 100,000 procedures in 1 year, 100,000 LASIK wow. procedures, 1 year. You know, it taught me the critical value of standardization.
Sure.
And the scientific part taught me how to analyze things to see what quality control meant in a field called refractive surgery, which is so easy to do quality control on because everything is measurable.
Yeah, numbers.
It's just numbers, right? And so that background led me to, you know, when I came back to London, I didn't know what I was going to do. I came back because I got kind of headhunted by Zeiss Meditech to consult on the laser that they were developing, which became the Mel-80. And I took a leap because the pay was sufficient for me, my wife, and a one-year-old to live on without surgery. And I thought, well, I'll figure out the surgery later. Right. And one of my best friends from boarding school here in England, Craig Engelfried, and I met at this school. And what are we doing 30 years later? He's still in London. We bump into each other through coincidence. And he said, well, why don't you start your own clinic? And I was like, oh, I don't really know anything about business. He goes, well, you just need, what? So we have this like 2-hour discussion. And he's like, okay, I'll stay for a couple of months and help you. But I need to get back to the States. And I'm like, no problem. He's from California. And 25 years later, he was still here.
Wow.
Because, you know, he's American in England. And, you know, customer service, marketing, sales. I mean, these are dirty words, but marketing means people need to know where to find you. Sales right. means people need to understand the advantages of your offering versus your competition. You know, I don't like the words, but I mean, the fact is, if you're honest and what you say in marketing is true, there's no problem with that. It, you know, the problem is when I'm the best or we're the best or we have the best technology, when you don't have the best technology and you're not, that's the problem. Yeah. The other bad one is when someone really is the best, but they're hiding in a corner and they're doing discount surgery at a chain.
Mm.
You know, that. None of if there's congruity, it's good.
Right, for sure.
Yeah, right. I mean, you look at you. I first got a whiff of you, and you looked just like that picture that you showed in South Africa.
Oh my gosh, yeah. the years have been cruel to me. I got beaten with the ugly stick when I got older.
You look very distinguished now. It's good.
I mean it's old, but thank you. In your clinic now. Are you still, you're still doing most, for let's say your keratofractive surgery, mostly femto-based lenticular stuff like SMILE, or you're mostly doing LASIK or both?
So our actual split is 80% SMILE, you know, 29% LASIK and 1% surface procedures. That's our actual split. And we do cataract surgery here, but as we discussed in South Africa, we do very little clear lens exchange.
Sure.
Because we, you know, we have Presbyon out here outside of the U.S. Jurisdiction. And so that, you know, buys us 10, 15, 20 years on a patient who can then come back for cataract surgery later with a monofocal.
Right. I don't know. That makes a ton of sense. Why do you think in the U.S. that lenticular stuff like SMILE hasn't really taken off? It's still a very small part of the market.
If I knew the answer to that, I would go to Zeiss and say, if you pay me a lot of money, I'll tell you the secrets. they haven't cracked it. The device is expensive.
Sure.
And LASIK is a phenomenal procedure.
Right.
So it's not like PRK versus LASIK. It's kind of very equivalent.
Right.
Yes, the dry eye lasts less time. It's like weeks instead of months. Okay, I get it. But really, I'm going to pay like $500,000 for a machine that does this? Well, the answer is you should. But you know, the market is in the U.S. for refractive surgery has been very stagnant.
Right, even down this year.
Down, and there's been a hell of a lot of downward pressure on prices. So ophthalmologists have kind of shot themselves in the foot here, because they're, you know, LASIK is a absolutely life-changing event that takes to 8 minutes and heals in 3 hours. Right. And the technology to do it and the expertise to repeatedly punch out perfect procedures is not trivial.
Sure.
Like doing a little bit of LASIK on Friday is not the same as being a professional.
Right.
Like someone doing four cataracts a week is not Uday Devgan, you know? So it's somehow we've devalued our expertise, but in a sense, it's not us that's done that. It's really the corporate practice of medicine that's kind of squeezed this down, and there's always someone willing to operate for less. And
right.
You know, it's like, we're in a bit of a rut there, I think, in the U.S. But having said that, I do think that SMILE is going to take off in the U.S. because,
okay.
And I'll tell you why. Because it is a far less onerous procedure for the patient.
Okay.
I mean, when you come to visit, which I hope will be very soon, I mean, it is like, LASIK is like magic. Try SMILE with a Visimax 800. I mean, I've had it for 4 years and I'm still like, whoa, that, what?
Yeah.
Because the patient lies down and the arm comes down, then the other arm comes down with the microscope, and then it's finished and it takes 2 minutes. So I've got the patient from lying down to sitting up is 6 minutes.
Yeah.
I mean, and they don't feel anything, right? The contact lens on the Visimax, you feel nothing. It's not like an FS200 or one of these things, which still drive the pressure up to 200. This is, the pressure goes up to 30. It's the same as you do this, you know? So the patient feels nothing. It's a magic trick. They're healed overnight. And then the next day they say, well, when can I start running? Well,
right now.
You can run home from here if you want. Oh, but I can't do any contact sports. I go, well, racquetball? Yeah, of course. what about soccer? They call it football here.
Yeah.
I translated that for you. I'm like, yes. It's like, well, what if someone elbows me in the eye? Like,
you'll be okay.
There's no moving parts, right? It's no move. You can do a Taekwondo class this afternoon. You'd be fine. There is something about that immediate recovery with minimal invasive surgery, which, okay, there's some financial barriers to it,
mm-hmm.
but in other words, I guess in answer to your question, the barrier to SMILE growing in the U.S. is financial, not that the procedure isn't successful. You know, there have been 13 million SMILE procedures performed outside of the United States.
Sure.
So there's nothing new about SMILE.
You know, I think part of it too, though, in the U.S. we don't get the same software. We're usually behind on that. So
that was true of the I'm sorry, I'm
Oh, the previous one. Yeah, maybe the previous laser. We didn't have the same software. We didn't have the same, the incision size was bigger. We had, we couldn't adjust the energy the same way.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. No, 100%. But that, my darling, is not because surgeons in the US are not the best trained in the world, second to none, all that stuff. It's because of the way that the FDA works.
Yeah.
So the FDA is so incredibly rigid, so incapable sometimes of simple extrapolation that they, you know, it's almost like lacking in common sense, the way that they require companies to do trials. And so in the case of the Visimax 500, the FDA trial started around the time that we had started doing it in Europe, like the applications went in. Sure. And it took 2 or 3 years to get those applications through and approved, and this trial started. But in those 2 or 3 years, those are the years when I, you know, went through the learning curve of Smile, which ended up being, you know, this textbook.
Yep, for sure.
Which, you know, it's like I've got like 20 pages on energy settings.
Right.
Because you have to understand the energy settings to get great results. And what we learned was no longer applicable to the US trial because the settings were fixed.
Right.
And, you know, this is where I think the FDA needs to make some changes, because they're like, we made our decision. We're going to carry on like this and finish the trial. It's like, but the setting, if you change the settings, the visions are going to be so much better on day one. We made our decision and we're not going to change anything. It's a little bit like the British, you know, we've made our decision, you know.
Well, I mean, there are a lot of those kind of crazy things in ophthalmology. Like, we cannot have T2 torque lenses. So the lowest power torque lenses in the USA correct one diopter at the corneal plane. We can't have the ones that correct 0.6 or 0.7 diopters at the corneal plane. So we have Alcon, let's say T3, T4, T5, T6. We can't have T2. And the reason is, in the trials, the difference in the outcome between non-toric versus toric wasn't large enough. It's just some nonsense.
The trial would have been people who were just using torics for the first time. And so it's the same with the Smile. You know, my erstwhile excellent colleagues who were in the FDA trial, they were doing their first 60 eyes as part of the trial.
Right.
Now, I had already done several thousand eyes. My next 60 eyes would have been way better than their first 60 eyes, because my first 60 eyes were actually worse than their 60 eyes, because they didn't have the benefit of what we'd learned. What I'm saying is, the whole way that the US treats new stuff in ophthalmology is very arcane.
Yeah, yeah.
It's very arcane. There's not enough common sense, not enough extrapolation. We'd like to see the FDA being a lot more cooperative with surgical logic, and those of us who are experts who can help them, show them that it's not more risk to do this and expand, expand the optical zone to 7 millimeters. But the trial didn't have any 7 millimeter eyes. Well, I know, but here's 4,000 eyes from London Vision Clinic at 7 millimeters.
Yeah.
It's the same. And like, nope, got to do a trial in the U.S.
Well, same with Presbyon.
Same with Presbyon. But we're hoping that we can, we really are hoping to approach them about Presbyon in a way that shows them that there is nothing we're doing that they aren't already familiar with, meaning LASIK, they're familiar with that. Yeah. Aspheric profiles, they're familiar with that. Monovision, they approved the Visimax for Monovision, so that they're familiar with that. There's nothing about Presbyon that's new, like literally. It's just a system that weaves through those three components, and it works really well.
I can attest to that. So I'm a -2 uncorrected both eyes, and obviously my near vision is fantastic. And we were at dark table with candlelight, and you could read as well as me. The difference is I couldn't see across the room without my glasses.
Yeah, 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 yeah. Well, like I said, I'm waiting for you to visit.
In 3 minutes and I, 2 minutes and I, we'll be done.
That's right. That's right. And it doesn't hurt. Don't worry.
The interesting thing there is it's actually quite a brilliant way of elongating the depth of field or depth of focus by changing you again, what sphere collaboration.
That's right. Well, isn't it a funny story? Because, you know, nowadays, every ophthalmologist in the world knows the acronym EDOF.
Right.
Everyone knows that word.
Right.
Well, presbyond is the original EDOF.
Interesting.
Because what is EDOF? It's extending the depth of focus.
Right.
You can do it by taking three foci and squashing them together so they kind of like continuum, or like in the symphony, two foci with a diffractive lens, which are squashed together, or like the Vividi, which is three foci, which are squashed together. But those are multifocal refractive lenses. Or you can do something like, what do you have in the States that are spherical lenses? Like, I mean, the SA60 from 1995 that I was putting in,
yeah,
that's spherical.
Right, right.
So you could do a patient, you know, you had a hyperope, so you put in a plus 25 lens.
Mm-hmm.
In the eye, it had a lot of spherical aberration. They could read without glasses if they were, even though they were plano.
Right.
So the original EDOF was spherical lenses.
Right.
And then the industry got really clever and said, oh, we have to make them aspheric. Oh, one company even said, oh, the cornea is plus 0.27. Let's subtract 0.27 and make the eye zero spherical aberration. Like, no, don't do that. Don't do that. There's no depth of field. Anyway, so now we're back to spherical lenses.
I know. How interesting is that? Well, the idea behind it was, right, in a young person, in a 25-year-old, yes, the cornea has a little plus positive spherical aberration. The lens has negative, so then it's zero. But a 25-year-old also has, like, six diopters of accommodation. So they don't need to worry about it.
Good.
The problem is when you turn presbyopic, you lose your accommodation. When your human lens shifts towards zero and then plus spherical aberration, it can be kind of helpful because even at a you know, 50-year-old who's emmetropic has overall a little bit of plus spherical aberration, you're just extending that more to, again, increase the range they can get.
That's right. That's right. So lenses in the States, do you feel deficient from apart from torics? Do you feel like you don't have the right selection?
Slowly are getting more and more now, but still it's limited compared, because I travel, I lecture all over the world, right? Especially in Europe or in Asia, there's so many other choices of lens that we just don't have available in the U.S. Some basic ones, like the Artisan Iris Clip lens for treatment of aphakia. In the USA, we don't have these. So if I got an eye with no capsule support, but a beautiful, nice, strong iris, if I was outside the U.S., I could just get this lens, clip it to the back of the iris.
The back of the iris,
and they're done.
Yeah.
But no, not here. We've got to do Yamane or Gore-Tex sutured in lenses. It's just like, really?
Right. Yeah. Fascinating. So if the FDA was there to protect the American public, if the American public has to have a more complex, higher complication rate procedure because something that's available elsewhere has not come in, and they'll say, well, do the trial. And it's like, well, you just say that, that's do the trial. That's three words, but it's 30 million and 5 years work.
Well, and plus we already have, or did have approved, the iris clip lenses for treatment of ultra high myopia, minus 15 and above, right? The old Varisize or Artisan lenses.
That's right.
Those are approved.
Right.
You already have the same kind of lens. And this is even better because you're putting it on the back of the iris, not the front of the iris. Yeah. And it's treatment of aphakia, which, come on already.
Yeah. No, you're right. You know, yeah. Well, if we talk more about, like, no, we don't want to, I was quite conscious of doing this conversation with you and making all of our friends feel bad.
No, because
I'm the guy. I can really make my American fellow citizens feel bad because I live in England, so I'm fine. But I'm board certified in the U.S., so you know it's like I've got the credential, but I'm cheating, right? I sit in London. I can do whatever I want. If I was sitting in New York, I'd be, you know, my hands would be, you know.
Yeah, for sure.
Not by ice, because, you know, but then my mother's Hungarian. Maybe I would count as a refugee and, you know, I'd get. Anyway, I was going to say the MS3, this is an interesting thing.
Tell me.
Because this comes down to, again, the question of risk benefit, cost benefit. The fact is that this device, which can measure the epithelium with 3D, in 3D, you know, in 1 second, and it is perfectly registered to the tomography because it comes from the same device, mm-hmm. and it has an axial length in it at the same time, so you can get ray tracing IOL calculations done. So I have, when we have an RKI, it's amazing because we just throw out all the other equations that are doing kind of regression analysis, right. and we just ray trace that eye with its aberrations, with everything in it, and it reduces the point spread function, and it says this is the lens that reduces the least the point spread function. So I mean, this machine is like this, like a that's right, it's like a Swiss Army knife, but it's made in Italy, so it's an Italian Army knife. Okay. It does everything, and especially for refractive surgery, able to see the flap, the interface. If you do a smile procedure and you want to do a circle to do an enhancement, you can measure the cap all the way around, see where it is, do your programming, looking at the RST for an enhancement. It's like it switches. It's like doing refractive surgery with the lights off. When you have that machine, it's doing refractive surgery with the lights on. You
know? Yeah, that's true too. Now, one thing I really liked when we were in South Africa, at their meeting, they had a great session of kind of give us your best pearls, and you had a really great one. This was on the Sunday. You kind of broke your life pearls, and you had 5 great pearls that were just like, wow. I made a note to myself, be sure to ask him about this on the podcast.
Because my goodness.
Yeah, you better pull those slides up. But it was a great session. My talk was that how I realized in life, it's all a zero-sum game. So if you're enjoying life, but life is great, then enjoy it because the tough times are on the corner. And on the contrary, if you're in the dumps right now, just hang in there. The good times are coming soon. So that was my talk. But yeah, you had a fantastic talk. If you can pull that up.
The reason I'm looking for it is because, I don't know if you remember, but, oh, there it is, top tips, is because I was sitting there and they were saying, oh, yeah, you're in the session. I'm like, oh, am I? And I didn't even know I was in the session. So I was watching you all do your thing. And I thought, well, oh, God. All right. So that's the beauty of PowerPoint, right? So I sat down and I thought, right, what are my top tips?
This is so good. If you're a young ophthalmologist, take notes. If you're an old ophthalmologist, take notes. This is really good.
So I'll just read them out. I mean, you know, the first one was marketing. And we talked about that earlier. Market the truth.
All right.
Don't extrapolate. It's hard to lie and cover another lie.
Right.
It's better to, like, if you're not the best surgeon on the planet, find another reason why people should come to you.
Right.
You know, you have, you know, you're warm, you're this, you did a degree in psychiatry, you were a psychiatrist before you became an ophthalmologist, you understand anxious patients, whatever it's going to be. Find your reason why people, don't, right. Just like we're the best, we have the best technology. Don't be generic about it. You know, we're all individuals. We're all different. The other thing was testing, and it was to do with risk benefit, cost benefit. Don't save $80,000 on an MS-39
to get
5 complications that are going to ruin your entire year, let alone ruining those 5 patients' lives.
Right.
Be bimanual. Was one of them. And of course for you, that's, but I have fellows coming to me always saying, sorry, no, I'm going to do the smile on the left eye with my right arm. I go, not here. You're going to do it with your left hand. Say, I can't operate with my left hand. And here's what I say. I say, okay, so you do phaco. Yes. So which hand do you hold the phaco in? Well, my right hand. Okay. Let's see. What does your right hand do?
Nothing. Yeah. The chopper, however.
What does your left hand do?
Yeah, all over the place with the chopper, for sure.
Yeah.
For sure.
So it's, you know, it's in the head by manuality. So everyone should be by manual, and operating on left eyes with left hands is actually has a lot of mechanical advantages than, you know, doing this with your wrists and whatever.
Yeah.
Standardization, of course, we talked about that earlier. You know, if you watch a video, we record all our surgeries, you can grab a video out of a folder and watch a smile procedure. I don't know who did it. I don't know if I was doing that or Glenn was doing that. I don't know, because we do it exactly the same way. And if something happens that's a difficulty, we get around it the same way. So mm-hmm. everything is the same way. It's like airline, you know, fuel ran out. Okay, go to page 7, turn to whatever. June. Yeah. That didn't work. Okay, page 8, do this thing. Complications are managed in a standard way. I mean, this is what you live for. Sure. And then a follow-up. Do see your own post-op day ones, was what I said. You learn so much from critiquing yourself.
Yeah.
I'm sure you're a big proponent of this. You know, if
they want always.
Yeah.
Because mostly I want to get the thank you and the hug from the patient.
The last thing I said, follow up to the end outcome. Right. In other words, you know, a lot of surgeons will say, yep, you're 1 month. Yep, you're 20/20. Everything's great. Fantastic. And then they never see the patient again. And then they come back 4 years later, plus 1 minus 2 at 90, and there's inferior steepening.
Yeah.
And it's like, if you'd seen that patient at 1 year for 15 minutes, done a topography, an auto refraction, you know, wave the magic wand, you would have had that data and you would have seen that that thing was starting to go. You would have cross-linked there and then, patient would have never heard from it again. So somehow, it is worth, and plus it's good for your, excuse me, marketing, right? Yeah. If you're someone who's seeing your patients at the 1 year mark for a blessing and everything's great and well done, yeah, you're stable, it shows you care, but you're also giving better care and you're probably avoiding some problems that, you know, you could have avoided.
In your clinic then, so you're seeing, let's say you do a patient, young routine patient, do their smile procedure, you'll see them back then once a year perpetually?
No. At the 1 year. So the 1 year data is the final result of whatever surgery.
Okay.
And if something changes in the future, you've got your MS39, your epithelial map, your posterior surface, and you could do your difference maps and you can really know where they were coming from. Mm-hmm. You know, if someone is let me give an example of what we catch. We have the patient who is plus a quarter, minus a half at 180, 2016 uncorrected, super happy at 3 months.
Sure.
They come in. This is an actual patient. Comes in at 1 year for the 1 year check. Still 2016 minus 2.
Okay.
Now plus a half minus 0.75 at 90. Still 2016 minus 2. But that SIL went from 0.5 at 180
to the other way,
to 0.75 at 90. That's a 1.25 diopter shift in SIL. Alarm bells, back surface difference map, holy moly, right where that little difference is, the epithelium is actually thinner than it was at 3 months. Crosslink, never heard from that eye again. So it's to do with the highest, you know, like if you're, what would you do for your own sister kind of
thing. Sure, for sure.
Yeah. Okay, a lot of time spent on that one. But then come the last two. One is to do with your work family. So I got that term from our good friend Vance Thompson.
Sure.
You know, he's a guru at the psychological aspects of a practice, but he called it work family. And I knew immediately what he was talking about because Craig and I were determined to be the best employers, not just the best at what we do. And so we spent a lot of money actually on making our staff happy, mm-hmm. not just on a day-to-day basis, but, you know, we'll set some targets, for example, and then give them a big hug. You know, Craig, the first time we did this, the big hug, was about 12, 13 years ago. And the market was doing quite well. And we said, okay, here's the thing. If we do 10% more surgery next year, if we do 10% more surgery, all 50 of you are going for 4 days to Las Vegas.
From London?
From London.
That's great.
And they made it by the skin of our teeth. The last patient was treated on the 28th of December because, and they were like scrambling for this patient to get that 10%. We took 50 people over to a day flight to we stayed at the Trump Hotel, which had just been built. And so it was empty. We got a really good deal. And, you know, can you imagine? It's like, talk about team building. So treat your staff like family. And you know, when they're happy, they smile more. When they smile more, the environment is better. The people, you know, a patient walks in and just feels the vibe that, yeah, you know, this is a happy place. I'm not telling anything that you don't already know, but and the last thing that I mentioned was, don't, you know, treat your work family, you know, like that, but don't take the eye off the ball on your blood family.
Yeah.
And you and I had some real heart to hearts a few years ago in South Africa about that. And, you know, we understand what we did. We recognize it. We were young. We were obsessional about perfection. And there was a cost to that. There is a cost to that, you know. And so now, I don't want to emphasize that point too. I mean, that point hits home for people from your age up to my age.
Yeah, right? For sure.
But the problem is that the I think the younger generations now, you know, ophthalmologists in their late 20s, early 30s, they're talking about work-life balance a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And they're talking about working part-time. And, you know, I would have liked to work part-time also when I was 33. But there is no way on any planet in the, of the billion planets apparently that there are in the universe, there is no one who works 3 days a week at the age of 33 as a surgeon and gets as good as you can get if you work full time.
Yeah.
And you know, it's the same in music.
Yeah.
10,000 hours. It's the same in, you've seen how many residents and fellows have you, you know, nurtured and seen, you know, stay there and go there. And what's the difference?
Work. It's all work. Yeah. That's the catch. You know, there's a saying that life has four burners. There's the, like a stovetop, there are four burners, and you don't have enough gas that all four can't run at the same time, right? It's like, this is some Silicon Valley saying. And so the four burners, I think, would be like your career, your health, your family, and your friends. And you can only get two burners cranking. You can do all four that are simmering, but if you want two pots really boiling, that's all you can do. Then the other two are going to suffer. And a lot of us made the mistake, at least I made the mistake of like, friends and family a little bit on the back burner, and then let me just prioritize my career and my learning and my ophthalmology, and also for me, also on the health side. But I kind of vary back and forth, and I've not been able to have all four burning hot at the same time.
I like that way of thinking of it. Yeah. It's a lesson, you know. And you're, you know, a good 10 or so years younger than me, and you've learned that. I didn't know that when I was your age. I was still trying to burn all four, and of course, you know, some of them got less gas.
Yeah.
And you know, you can't go back. You can't do it again. So you know, it's yeah.
But you can learn. We can all learn. That's the beauty of it. We can learn from it, change things, do things a little differently now.
Yeah.
Look, we're obviously trying to have a little bit more balance in our lives now. But you're right. I think, let's say for anything, like whether it's playing music, if you're committed to playing a couple hours every day, you make a lot more progress than picking it up for an hour once a week. Well, surgery is no different. If you're committed to doing a huge volume of surgery,
yeah,
you're going to, there's in every person, every surgeon, there's a humongous difference between case 500, case 5,000. There's a big difference.
And you know what? I agree with that. But now, but then when you get to the case 25,000,
right?
That's another level.
Yeah. Well, then you realize how much you actually just don't know. 25,000, 50,000 cases, some huge number. Then you realize, like, you know, we don't all know all that much.
Right. Right. I still can't crack that.
Right.
I don't know what. But what happens at that point is that your automism becomes so natural that when you're operating, like your background systems are taking care of unusual things without you having to think that's an unusual thing.
Yeah. State of flow.
I had a medical student visiting me. He said, "Oh, I want to do ophthalmology." He's a friend of my son's who's at medical school here. And he came and, you know, watched a day of procedures. And actually that particular day, I guess I was maybe 10 patients that had SMILE and maybe 5 that had LASIK. So in the VisionMax 800, I mean, like I said, it's 6 minutes, boom, 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 boom. What, is that over? Yeah, well, yeah, it's done. And so one after the other, right? One after the other, one after the other. And at the end, we finished and we were in the corridor and he said, "Yeah, I really want to do ophthalmology. I'm still very interested. And thank you very much. Probably refractive surgery is not going to be the specialty that I'm interested in." I said, "Okay. Oh, why is that?" Well, he said, well, he's trying to be polite. He said, I mean, what's it like to like do like 10 patients, 20 eyes the same over and over again? I mean, doesn't that get a little, you know, boring?" I said, he goes, "Well, yeah." I said, "I didn't do the same thing on every one of the 20 eyes."
Right.
I said, "There's something completely different on each of the 20. To you, it looked the same."
Right. Yeah, yeah.
Right?
To me, every cataract is different. Absolutely.
Come on. This is the beauty of that level of automation.
Right.
That no matter what, it's that eyelid, it's like the speculum, you know, the upper lid has more force. So the speculum's like this, and you've got less room, you know, at the superior limbus. Or they're a super squeezer, or they keep on belling, you know, there's all that stuff that can totally derail a case.
Yeah.
Or the iris, you know, is, you didn't expect it, but, you know, it's bloody floppy, you know, or whatever, you know.
All those things, yeah, for sure.
And once you get to that, like, supreme, you know, love supreme level that, you know, that John Coltrane talked about, anything like that is also routine.
Yeah.
So you see it and you go, okay, now we do this.
Kind of like how you improvise in jazz. You just do it naturally. You don't have to think about it.
Well, that is the analogy. And that is the analogy. And I have no doubt that the brain stretching and torture that I did in my little Berkeley practice room in Boston, you know, practicing, you know, I'm no doubt that the skill set that I acquired to then improvise meant that my experience as an improvising musician has led me to be able to think laterally very quickly and to react to different situations. Like the drummer does this and I'm like, "Oh, that's a good idea. I'll pick up on it." Or the pianist, you know, goes off. You know, it's the interaction between the players, listening, immediate decision-making, and creativity at the same time.
Right.
Now, what I just said there, that I could literally have been talking about cataract surgery or smile surgery.
Absolutely. And how did I just and it happens just so naturally and effortlessly.
Yeah, it's a beautiful thing. Beautiful thing.
Dan, this is too much fun. We've been talking for well over an hour here. Can you imagine?
Oh, my goodness.
Glad you're having fun.
It was like 30 minutes.
So again, I want to thank you so much for doing this podcast. Always so enlightening, so much to learn from you, and truly been a pleasure.
Well, have me back.
I would love to.
All right.
And I'll remind viewers, remember, listeners and viewers, we've got a new podcast every Sunday on Apple, Amazon, Spotify, Google, wherever you find a podcast, you find the Cataract Coach podcast. Of course, we have new Cataract Coach video every day, 2,900 and counting. And check out our sister channel, Retina Rounds, for retina videos and a retina podcast. So until next time, I'll catch you later.